When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They become pawns in the greater games, and they're unable to decipher what's happening. The operational head of this, if I may call them the mafia, are the military. So if you're in the military, it's like living in standard deviation.
What went wrong for Imran Khan?
Historically, they've used Islam as a narrative to bring people together. People who have money can have access to healthcare and education. It's hard to articulate the kind of destruction the IMF program brings in for the masses.
The common narrative, of course, is that the Americans forced him out.
Imran Khan's policies were capitalist and neoliberal as they get.
These past few weeks in Pakistan have been a roller coaster ride. We have seen the continued brazen army interference in elections that for so long has earned the country the dubious title of possessing a sham democracy. The country's elected leader, Imran Khan, is languishing in prison on what are trumped-up charges, and hundreds of his party members have been chased, arrested and incarcerated by what can only be described as the apparatus of a deep state. Election day was a sham, and it seems the army's designated successors are about to take their positions. But often, what is on the surface may conceal deeper facts. Today we have political analyst Kashif Gilani from Islamabad to discuss the situation with us. Rav Kashif Gilani, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to the Thinking Muslim podcast.
Walaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us. Now, I know you've recently come from Islamabad, and it's really a pleasure to have you join us today. Now, Kashif, let's start with the current situation. Pakistan is going through a turbulent week, as I said. Imran Khan's PTI party was not allowed to contest the recent election, so effectively a band of independents stood to represent his ticket in the parliamentary elections. And they received the greatest share of the vote, or at least the seat share, in parliament. Can you take me through some of the attempts in this past week to thwart, to challenge his party, or at least his independence?
Sure. So this is something that happens almost in every election, that there's a favorite party of the ruling elite, and I call them the establishment. And then they use multiple tactics to make sure that the people that they want in power come in power. So Imran had his share of the favor of the establishment, but in recent times he's fallen out of their favor, and they've used multiple tactics to discredit him or make sure that he doesn't form the government. It began with them pressurizing people who were within his party to leave and form another party called Istiqam Pakistan, and then they used pressure tactics to make sure that people who wanted to take his party ticket for the election do not, and opt for other parties. And then there was election day rigging, where people didn't allow them to have online jalsas or congregate. So any political work that goes on through the election, they were denied that mostly. And then on top of that, So in Pakistan, you need a symbol to vote.
Why? Why do you need a symbol?
So it's just a procedure and thing. You stamp the symbol, and that's how they count the vote. So they don't want the name of the person you're voting for or the name of the party. So it's a symbol that you vote on.
Yeah.
And because of some legal issues, and that we could get into later as well, they were denied this. And the optics definitely look really bad, even though there's legal merit in the case how it was laid out. And I would say that PTI were lazy in fighting their case, at least in the Supreme Court. But there's clear reason for them to deny it by the establishment. They've been, so the reason used to deny them, they've been doing this throughout their over two decades of history. They've been conducting elections like this. But this became relevant because the establishment didn't want them in power. And then even during the election, on the very election day, people finance election campaigns. Those people who would finance PTI's election campaigns, they weren't allowed to give. It was made difficult for them to give them money so that they could transport voters from their houses to the voting stations. The controversy that's become really popular is that from every constituency, they have this Form 45 where they count the total votes, and then they are compiled and posted on Form 47. So there's a discrepancy on who won on Form 45 and who was eventually considered the winner on Form 47. So it's very clear that the state did maneuver and made sure that Imran Khan doesn't form a government in this election.
And the internet went down on election day.
Yes, that happened too.
And why? What was the rationale behind bringing down the internet?
So generally, it's done so that people do not coordinate, or if something's happening, people don't post it online very quickly. So generally, that's it. Perception is that's why it was put in place. But this isn't something that's uncommon in Pakistan. Whenever there's congregations, the government makes an excuse for a security threat and takes down the cell phone service and the internet service throughout the country. So it's not something very uncommon. But the optics definitely look really bad for the establishment. And that's something I think we should get into as well. That,
yeah.
Why was Imran Khan denied this? And why was he popular in the first place? And this isn't something, this popularity isn't something that's a stable reality. He was exceptionally unpopular 1.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And people thought his politics is over. And now he is probably more popular than he was during 2018 election. And there's an undercurrent in the Pakistani society that defines who becomes popular and who doesn't. And I think that's something interesting that we should go into. And I should preface this with this, that my intention to come here and talk about these things is that I've noticed that especially the Muslim voice, they become pawns in the greater games, and they're unable to decipher what's happening. And this is something that the Muslim voice needs to be capable of. Otherwise, they will always be used in these streams of narratives that are popular. So if we are able to present a framework that's useful for people, even if they disagree with the framework, they would be able to have a structured thinking, inshallah, that would help people understand the Pakistani situation.
Fantastic. So you've used the term establishment, elites, in that answer. Who are the establishment? Who are the elites?
So this is something that we need to go back into history to understand. Pakistan has a colonial history where it inherited certain institutions from the British India. And those institutions are three in number mostly, which is the Pakistan military, the civil bureaucracy, and the political structure, the parliament. In Pakistan's case, the political, the people who were considered the founders of Pakistan, they did not have a political base in this part of the world. They were mostly based out in UP. So they were very weak when Pakistan was created. And the military was always stronger along with the civil bureaucracy. So that's, the military has eventually become the establishment. And that's partly because this part of the world, in this part of the world, the military owned most of the land. The British had given people who retired from the military, who they had been conscripted for World War I and II, they retired them here in this part of Pakistan, and they were given land. And the major cities that the British developed here were also cantonments. So the military was disproportionately powerful in this part of the world anywhere but Pakistan and Somalia. And then the civil bureaucracy leaned towards the British during and after after the inception. And the world was moving towards an American world order, where post-World War II, America had become powerful in the international circles, and it was dictating who gets to keep its colonies and not, and who doesn't. So in such a situation, there's a lot of academic work to prove that America put forward its soldier reform within Pakistan. And those soldier reforms disproportionately made the military elite even more powerful than the rest of the institution, the colonial institutions Pakistan had inherited. But I wouldn't say the elites and the ruling elites is just the military. So it's a nexus of businessmen, judges, people in the civil bureaucracy, especially the military generals, and some landlords too, who hold huge pieces of land, and a party, I would say, are politicians and businessmen at the same time. So these are the ruling elites, but at the center of the operational head of this, if I may call them the mafia, are the military.
So, and when we're talking about the military, we're talking about Bajwa, Munir, you know, the heads of the military.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Now, how unified is that political elite? Because you suggested earlier on that those who come through this electoral process are the ones who are favored by the political elites. So do the political elites always limit themselves to a singular party and candidate? Or how does that play out in the practice?
So it's not always one candidate. So let me tell you what the preferences of the establishment or the elites are, and then we'll be able to see how what choices do they opt for.
Mm-hmm.
So for the ruling elite, there are certain pillars of their decision making. One of them has been aligning with the U.S. So whoever the Americans think, whatever policy the Americans have for this region, and whoever can implement those policy prescriptions is usually becomes favored. And then there are local dynamics that determine who will be favored. And then in recent times, the military doesn't want to put all their bets on one horse. So they want a hung parliament, a coalition government anyway, so that they have more room to maneuver. So they don't want anyone to become too popular. They tried that with Nawaz Sharif, and it didn't play out well when he had a two-third majority.
Yeah.
So what are those things? Well, the first thing is they want to align with the U.S. And that's the history of Pakistan. Pakistan has developed economically. Pakistan has built its irrigation systems. And Pakistan has built its military weaponry with the help of the U.S. And it's those programs that there's an institutional memory of how do you make Pakistan better or good. And the military and the ruling elite generally think it's aligning with the U.S. So that's one of the pillars.
Yeah.
The second pillar is that everything this has to happen through the colonial state that they've inherited. They do not want to change. They're fine with some amendments or reforms within this structure, but they are not in favor of entirely revamping the system. There are some debates of using the parliamentary, the presidential system versus the parliamentary system, but that's about it. There isn't a conversation of major reform. There's the conversations of the civil-military balance of power in the regime's become too large, maybe cut down their budget, and there's an economy outside of this budget that the military has access to, maybe it shouldn't have access to. So those are the only conversations that they have. But majorly, the ruling elite agrees that they will implement, whatever they implement will be through this state. And then there's the third part that the ruling elite agrees with is that there has to be a national identity. That national identity, historically, they've used Islam as a narrative to bring people together. And that began very early on. Probably it has roots in the formative story. Jinnah used this narrative as well, and it continued with Ayub Khan and everybody else who came into power. But recently, the rulers have started to move away from this. Since Musharraf, the ruling elite have been moving away from this narrative of using Islam as the binding force. So they want to use Pakistan's identity or its traditional roots, its link with India, and everything except Islam to define this. So these are the three things that are close to the heart of the military and the establishment when they're making those decisions. And whoever they are not fine with generally doesn't align with them in some of these things. But I would posit that Imran wasn't doing any. Imran aligned with them in most of the things except for his narrative. So the narrative that's becoming popular in Pakistan is also threefold. It's the people of Pakistan want Islam to be at the center of whatever ruling structure that they have. So there's a narrative, the popular narrative is that the state is illegitimate. So for some, it's because of its colonial history. For some, it's because the judicial system doesn't deliver. But there's some popular cases in point, as you pointed out, Imran Khan's experience with the judiciary, but otherwise too, people can wait for generations to get their cases sorted. So there's a consensus that the judiciary doesn't work. Then the education system is completely broken down. People who have money, it's completely privatized. People who have money can have access to healthcare and education. So there's a consensus that there's a narrative that although there are soft powers that accept Pakistan as a legitimate Islamic state, but the popular narrative is that it's unable to deliver on any substantial Islamic promises. For instance, it can't even get rid of the interest. So the state has multiple times ruled against the interest, declared it haram, all over again, as if that's something we needed to learn. But the state is unable to even remove something so basic because it's, and we could get into that eventually, because it's entrenched with within the global economic system that even within the system of nation state and global finance, you will be able to get rid of interest that easy. So because of those promises not being delivered for all of the stakeholders, the state is illegitimate. Then, in terms of the second point is being pro-West or leaning towards America. Especially after 2001, but even before that, the Pakistani society has been moving away from, it's no more enamored with the Western ideals, and it's moving away from the promises of the liberal world. And that's another wedge that's been created within the ruling establishment and the gender propagation. I would say that Warren Dare cemented that for most of the people, even people within the ruling elite too. So I would say that even within the ruling elite, they're factions, so it's not a monolith. One of the factions was led by General Hamid Bhutto, who was the head of ISI in 1988. And he formed an alliance, IJI, that actually created an Islami Jamhuriya Ittehad, it was called. And it's launched Nawaz Sharif as the ruler of Punjab back then. So this idea had, it resonated with the ruling, a part of the ruling establishment as well. But after Musharraf, those parts of the ruling establishment were sidelined. So the second narrative that, but it still resonates with a lot of the people who are in the military, not the generals, but junior officers and the general population, that aligning with the West and leaning on the U.S. would not be fruitful. And it's especially after warrantarian Nawazab, that has cemented it for the people that depending on the military, depending on West and the U.S. and the global order will not unify us as an Ummah, will not allow us to implement Islam within our society or practice anything that is close to Islam. He poses as anti-American, where he talks about the Riyasat-e Madina, which is an Islamic state, and he talks about the illegitimate state, and he's been consistent with it. He began with judiciary, then he moved to the politicians, and now he's added the military establishment to the list. So that is what makes him popular.
But I gather in your tone that you're somewhat skeptical about whether he had enlisted upon this project of pushing back against the deep state. So let's talk about that. The Pakistani establishment allowed Imran Khan to come to power. They supported, I think that's a popular narrative which I would like you to address, but they supported him, or at least enabled him and his movement to come to power. I think that's perfectly acceptable to say. But of course, he fell out of favor sometime during his tenure. So talk me through that. What happened between Imran Khan and the political establishment for him to fall out of favor?
Okay. So I think I haven't substantiated the fact that although his narrative is what's on the street, like a populist narrative, which he's saying what people want to hear, but he is with the establishment on the other points. So for instance, while he's been saying that Donald Liu had a cipher and he kicked him out, but he was kicked out because of that. At the same time, he's been reaching out to the Americans and lobbying in America to make sure that he becomes acceptable for them, despite his street narrative. And he's even before that, he enabled the Trump government to broker a contract between them and the Taliban. He helped them to bring the Taliban on the table. And even during the Biden administration, when they wanted to get out of Afghanistan, he facilitated the whole project throughout. And when he went to meet Donald Trump, he was really happy, and he said it's a bigger victory than his World Cup. So he was on. He had agreed with the project of siding with the Americans, with the ruling establishment. And then his idea of...
But this was, to interrupt, but this is fine. But, you know, Imran Khan became prime minister on the back of his criticism of drone strikes, war on terror, Afghanistan, you know, the war that had sucked out a lot of Pakistan's energy and people and had created terrorism within its own borders. Are you saying that was no more than rhetoric, or was there a substantial policy initiative that we could cite that's anti-American?
So the part of the establishment that I said Hamid Gul was heading, this was their opinion.
Okay.
So in early 2001, Hamid Gul was able to create a faction within, so he headed that faction within the ruling establishment, who had all these senior narratives checked. They were anti-American. They wanted Islam having a greater role in the region. They coined the term of Pakistan's strategic depth that went all the way up to Central Asia. And they were very critical of their state, especially the part that belonged to the institution that was represented by the seasoned politician. So this is something that Hamid will popularize. And Imran Khan, he was recruited by Imran Khan, and there's ample evidence to show that. And Imran Khan bought this and agreed to this, and he understood the fact that this is the popular narrative. If he wants to come into power, he will have to use this. But 2001 was the switch in American policy towards Afghanistan discontinued this project for at least a decade. So Imran Khan fell out of favor of the establishment because Hamid Gul lost his power as the center of the establishment faction, and Musharraf became more powerful. So Imran's, even though he continued with this narrative, his narrative, and it was resonating with the people on the street, but Musharraf couldn't afford somebody who, and he offered him, Imran was willing to work with Musharraf too, but when he didn't get what he wanted to get, which is the seat of the prime minister, he continued with his the populist narrative, which was to attack the American war. But when it came to when the American policy shifted again, when they decided that they do not want to fight the war anymore and they want to pull back their military, at that time Imran was at the helm of the affairs, and he coordinated with the Americans, saying that we want a cordial relationship with the Americans. So in his narrative, he's been consistent in terms of saying where he talks to the international community, which is America and the Security Council. He says that he wants to coordinate with. So, and that's what the ruling elite want. So he's not contradicting them. That's the only point I wanted to make. So
why did he fall out of favor? If he's not contradicting them, if he continues the policy initiatives or the policy objectives of the majority of the establishment, what went wrong for Imran Khan?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what went wrong is that's also rooted in Pakistan's history. Mm. Pakistan's, the woes of Pakistan, the economic in a lot of dimensions.
Yeah.
So Pakistan, with the past four governments, if we include this one, the top agenda has been economics. Fixing Pakistan's economic problem. And that is exactly what got Imran Khan fall out of favor from the establishment. And Pakistan, so let me try to unpack how Pakistan's economy is organized and what's the problem. So Pakistan has never had a local economic thought. It has always borrowed from the colonial ideas and the American world order to solve its problems. So as I mentioned, initially when Pakistan was created, it depended on the World Bank and the IMF to create its agricultural system. Pakistan was actually worried at one point in time that it might not be able to produce enough food for the people who are migrating from India. But Pakistan was able to hit surplus in the 60s. How was that possible? It was possible because Pakistan took loans from IMF and World Bank and implemented the Green Revolution it was spearheaded by the Americans. They gave them the seeds, the technology, and they funded it to make sure that Pakistan increases its agricultural yield. And those neoliberal programs that the World Bank and the IMF initiated created a consumer economy in Pakistan. Even though it did industrialize Pakistan in some ways, the Imran Khan era, it increased the agricultural yield, but it also created a huge, a consumer economy, which Pakistan was not able to sustain. And now Pakistan has two basic problems. One is it has to import almost everything that the people use, which means there will always be a dollar deficit that Pakistan cannot fund. And then the state uses the state has a fiscal deficit, which means it is unable to generate enough money through taxes and whatnot. And it has to lean on its monetary policy, which is essentially printing money or taking loans. And in Pakistan, even the printing money comes through taking loans. So the commercial banks, they take loans from the state bank. The state bank prints money, gives them the loan on a lower interest rate, and then those commercial banks lend that money through the T-bills to the exchequer. So there's a debt cycle Pakistan is trapped in for the dollar economy and the functioning of the state, and that's the problem that the past four governments have been asked to resolve. And after the first two and since the ruling elite is convinced that the only way to resolve this problem is by genie on the American plan, which is working with the IMF, working with the World Bank. And Imran Khan, although he did follow through with this in the first 2 years, and then but that made him exceptionally unpopular.
Why?
Because the IMF plan breaks. So it's hard to articulate the kind of destruction the IMF program brings in for the masses.
High taxation.
It's
poor public services.
Not just that, it's incredible inflation. Incredible inflation. Yeah. Because they devalue the money. They, as you said, they increase taxes. They don't let the state subsidize anything. And they make sure that the state manages its monetary policy through the banks.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that Pakistan stays in that debt trap that it's going to the IMF in the first place. But on top of that, it makes sure that those interest-seeking banks stay afloat, but the people have to pay the price. So if I could just give you an example to make you understand that, in the past 5 years, the price of a car has gone from a normal sedan has gone from 20 lakh rupees to almost 50 lakh rupees, which is more than double. And 50 lakh rupees is so much money that if somebody is a new entrant into the labor force, they would not be able to save enough money maybe in their lifetime to buy a car.
Yeah.
So that means this program just in the past, this is the third government that will fourth government that will implement the IMF program consecutively.
Mm.
And just in these 5, 6, 7 years of time,
yeah,
Pakistan's middle class has completely disappeared.
Right. This was during Imran Khan's tenure. This was during the period where we see Imran Khan in power.
So it began during Haqqani Abbasi's rule. In his last year, it began then the recent IMF programs, and it continued through Imran Khan's tenure in the first 2 years, and then eventually COVID actually gave him a breather. So during COVID, IMF allowed Pakistan to not implement the policy prescriptions that they were forcing Pakistan's hand on, and he did what everybody else normally does, which is implement the IMF program. When they become too unpopular, you switch it back to printing money and funding the consumer economy. That creates both those debts, which is the fiscal deficit for the government and the dollar debt, because everything is imported, and that pumping in that money creates that consumer demand that asks the market to import items from abroad. Mm-hmm. So him doing that exacerbated the situation. So he did that for a year when IMF had given them a breather, but he continued doing it because he had become really unpopular, and he had to depend even more on the establishment for even smaller maneuvers within the parliamentary setup. And when the military saw that, just like all the other players that they've backed, he is unwilling to take the blame or to become unpopular and implement the American plan of going with the IMF. So they decided that there shouldn't be a switch in government. And they thought him being them both of them being in the on the same seat, it would be a bloodless, if I may say, transition. And they would be able to bring him back because they aren't comfortable with the other party anyway. And the other party is within the military, if I may say, their constituency. That means the officers and their families, they resonate. The narrative that resonates most with is the narrative that Hamid Gul came up with, which is anti-American, which is anti-political, historic political rulers, which is PMLN, People's Party, and it is a narrative where the identity of Islam has a role to play. Mm. So because the military establishment wanted him out, and he was stating the, he was empowering the narrative of the street and the people involved are within the military. He became really difficult to remove. And that is what we see eventually play out.
Right. So the common narrative, of course, is that the Americans forced him out. And, you know, Donald Wu and the cipher has become dominant in this story of Imran Khan's fall. Your argument seems to suggest that that may have played a part, but actually it was mostly down to domestic considerations. He fell out of favor with the army because he was no longer willing to implement the economic policy prescriptions of the army.
Yes. So he wasn't able to... So the army thinks, the establishment thinks, and the capitalists were associated with the military establishment think that neoliberal policies are going to resolve their woes.
Why did I think that? I mean, it's been years under this IMF World Bank prescription and the economy is flailing.
So their idea of how the world works is very rudimentary, I would say.
Really?
So in their experience, siding with the Americans has given them dividends. And that's the empirical evidence to say you do whatever the Americans say. So so for instance, they modernized their military with the American aid during the Zia era. They were able to resolve a lot of problems for their domestic economic problems when they received aid from Musharraf, and they were able to industrialize during the. All of them happened because of the American help. And then they see across the border towards India.
Yeah.
They see that America once has a greater role for India in the region against China. And that is what's making the Indian economy become so large, because America is willing to give India a share in the global supply chain. And that is what's making it export so much and develop a domestic economy. And they say that China was also able to develop because it was America allowed it to be a part of the global supply chain. And Taiwan also developed because of this. And South Korea also developed because of this. So if we lean towards the Americans, and they will give us a share of this global economy.
Yeah.
But what they do not understand is, or they underestimate, is that China didn't really follow through with the neoliberal policy they were acting. They don't appreciate the things that China didn't do and are still willing to follow what the Americans have prescribed.
But do you think that Imran Khan understood that? Because you've ascribed the word rudimentary to the policies of the deep state. But at least in some of Imran Khan's speeches where he talks about China, he refers to the China model, and he talks about at the United Nations, I remember, General Assembly, he talked about Shanghai versus New York and was making a comparison between the potholes in the New York streets and of the shining buildings in China. And maybe there is another model that we can subscribe to. Was that a recognition by Imran Khan that things are that is far more granular and far more advanced, maybe, than as you said, the ruling establishment?
So this is also a popular, this has been a popular narrative within part of the military establishment that siding with China might resolve these problems. So the military did move towards China in its arms development because they thought the Americans weren't dependable partners in the military's armament development. So they did side with China. And there are reports of even during Musharraf's era initiating the Belt and Road project with the Americans. So it's something that the military also has been thinking about. But, and they thought that China would be able to work with the a good partner for them to defend on, especially when dealing with India. But the military, that's where the cooperation with the Chinese ends. it's building the military infrastructure, it's getting the JF-17 built, and building a few other things. When it comes to actual policies, Imran Khan's policies were capitalist and neoliberal as they get. Whether it was initiating the health card, which is modeled on the American
insurance,
exactly. Whether it was privatizing schools, even if you look at narratives of it, of people who were right hand men like Fawad Chaudhry, then who would say that the state is not supposed to run petrol pumps, which is a neoliberal idea of making a case for privatizing national resources. And they were also making a case to privatize the steel mills and the NEA. So Imran Khan's policy prescriptions have been consistently neoliberal. But the narrative does sometimes say that he wants to use other models, but they don't play out in action.
Mm. But how does that then collide with the Riyasat Madina model, the Medina Islamic model that he talked about? And remember one speech where he discussed the first welfare state was established by the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. So how do we tie that imperative with what you describe there of a very neoliberal premised tenure of Imran Khan?
So I would say this has been a battle of all the populists who have tried to use the narrative of in Islamic, say, whether it was Mahdi Muhammad, who Imran Khan says that he's learned so much from, whether it's Erdogan Turkey, or was it whether it was Imran Khan, that they've tried to nationalize the Islamic project. They've tried to limit the Islamic project within a nation state, and that in itself is it's an oxymoron. It's an oxymoron. It doesn't work. So by its very nature, if you stick with the Westphalian idea, if you stick with the global financial institutions, if you do not want to confront the American model at its very core, at its very objectives, you would not be able to carve a place where you can actually implement Islam. And Islam cannot be, you can't pick and choose. For instance, even though he said Riyasat-e-Madina, but he wanted to model the parliamentary democracy of Britain. He wanted the welfare state of the Scandinavian movements, and he wanted the industrialization of the giants. So none of this makes sense. So nobody, all of these are the four different models that he's referring to, which gives credence to the idea that he's just being a populist. He's just saying whatever resonates with the people. And when it comes to policy prescriptions, his team has no ideas. He has no ideas. They end up depending on the IMF and the World Bank to tell them what is possible in this world. So when it came to actually implementing things, that's where he was stuck.
All right. I want to go back to an earlier point you made about the composition from within the army. And you described, especially at the time of Hamid Gul, that there was opposition to the westernized policies, and maybe the street narrative was more fairly reflected within this schism or this sector of the army. So the army is not a monolith. I think that's the point you made. Is that still the case today? Do we still have divisions within the army that are tussling for power, and how does that play out when it comes to Imran Khan's incarceration?
So the military is a very organized institution, and there's some things that there's an agreement on. One is that the Pakistani state is the military. That's an agreement within the army, and they don't disagree on this. But like any organization, there are personal ambitions that people want to get to the top, and there's always that infighting. Yeah. And then you could also, just like the society, you could broadly divide the military into inclinations and proclivities. For instance, there is a portion of the army that is Islamically inclined. You'd find people who are regular in their prayers. You'd find people who are crying for Baza. You'd find people who who weren't happy with the Pakistanis but leaning towards the Americans in the war if they weren't there. And then there are people who were nationalists who would say that our focus has to be Pakistan. So if America says Kashmir cannot be the central issue, we'll have to let it go. If saving the economy means a notch to give about Gaza, that's what we're going to do. If having JF Thunders means that China will supply them to the Myanmar, and they'll use it to kill the Rohingyas, we'll let it. So there's a nationalist segment that its focus is Pakistan. So, and that's them. And then there's a large portion of people who are just careerists. They're in the military because that's the institution that gives you the most perks. So it's if you're in the military, it's like living in standard deviation, if I were to borrow Imran Khan's words. Everything is paid for, from your teenage to until you die. Whether you, when you get sick, you'll get the top healthcare facilities in Pakistan, or even if you want to be flown outside Pakistan, you know, that option is also available. Your education, top-notch education, is you get it at an extremely subsidized rate, and then even the money that your disposable income will be matched with the inflation increment that the country has. So whether it's, and you get a piece of land to build your houses on, and you get agricultural land when you retire. So it's your life is set if you're part of the military. And as you will go higher up the ranks, you get more perks. Part of the military is careerists. So within these three broad sections, if I may call them, there are factions within who compete for position of power. So there are a few things that all of them agree on. One is that the state outside of the military is incapable of dealing with a lot of things. Foreign policy, domestic security, and now economy has also been added to the list because it's a national security issue. So those are things they think they have to be a patron of. That's an agreement across the board. And then there's an agreement across the board that the politicians are incapable, incompetent, and they have the vested interest to steal and loot when they come to power. So that's also a broad narrative that's acceptable within the military. So when Imran Khan fell out of favor of General Bajwa, there was a substantial number of people, even in the higher ranks, who supported Imran's narrative, yeah, that bringing back Nawaz Sharif and People's Party will not resolve this problem. We have a consensus that they are one of the causes of our problem. So it was very difficult for Bajwa to convince the military generals who had retired since Hamid Gul's time, and their family and their extended family, and a lot of people who were still in the military. It was very difficult for him to, so he had to strong arm the military to make sure. So people's pensions were cancelled. People would try it. People would let go. There were court martials against people who defied orders. So this was turned into a national security issue, especially the 9/10 incident where there was some violence on the street because of the support because of this clash. Mm-hmm. So Bajwa tried to turn this into Hafiz Saab tried to turn this into a national security issue, and then use this as a pretext to force people, even within the military, to hush them. But I would say, even though he was successful in hushing them, there's immense pressure on him to not be so heavy-handed with Imran, or he might not. So he's having a hard time. So there's still support for Imran within Imran in these three narratives that I've spoken about within the military.
Within the military, okay. And the relationship between the military and the United States. During the Musharraf era, we were conditioned almost to believe that the army is in effect a puppet of the United States, almost very similar to the Egyptian army and its close relationship with the Americans? I mean, how would you describe that relationship?
I would say the Americans imported the Pakistani model to Egypt, not the other way around. Pakistan is always... I would say this region was exceptionally important for the U.S. to control. And when Pakistan was created, it was right after World War II when the Cold War was picking up. And this region was Asia. There was a slogan within Pakistan, Asia Lal Hai, which means Asia is communist, essentially. And the communist bloc that the American treated as one bloc was becoming really strong within this area. And Pakistan was able to build its case to be America's forefront ally to resolve this dynamic. And America's experience with Yugoslavia told them that there's a chance that they can break this coalition. And they used Pakistan to bring China. They hadn't even recognized China back then. Taiwan was China. Mainland China didn't even exist. So they used Pakistan to break the communist bloc. And that's when the relationship started cementing for Pakistan, which is Pakistan became the forefront ally. And India, go back and say this, that when America started heading the world order, it asked France and Britain to let go of all its colonies. And because America wanted its own control, even though it portrayed itself as the same era in anti-colonial force, but it wanted to implement a neo-colonial model where America bought the larger share of things. Britain had the political savviness to not just divide the land in a way where America wouldn't be able to take the whole pie, but also create a non-aligned movement which it asked India to join in on. That allowed this part of the area to stay within the control of the Commonwealth or Britain. So Pakistan, from the very get-go, in order to deal with India, in order to build its local institutions that were lopsided or truncated when it inherited from the colonial times, and an economy that was very primary in its nature, in order to do all of that, Pakistan had to lean on to the MISCs. And that relationship cemented very early on. Because Pakistan's ruling structure was military-dominated, and within the first 10 years, the military was able to overpower the civil bureaucracy anyway. And the soldier reforms that were put in place from the very beginnings defined the relationship with the Americans. So people in Pakistan, unless they're trained, unless they go to West Point or initially it was Sandhurst, but now it's at West Point and other institutions, unless they're trained over there, they're not considered good soldiers, good officers. So it's a very deeply entrenched relationship that Pakistan military had with the Americans.
And how about China? Because again, in the West, it's very commonplace now to think about Pakistan as a close ally, if not the closest ally of China, or at least an important asset, that word's even used, of China. We have the CPEC corridor. We have, you know, Pakistan has been at the center of China's economic infrastructure. The trade relationships between China and Pakistan have grown in the last decade. And so we have this very strong relationship, and that's within the context of an international situation where America is threatened by the rise of China, its economic rise and its military rise. How does Pakistan fit into that battle between America and China?
So the Pakistani establishment has been grappling with this idea of using China and Russia as a balancing power towards them leaning on the Americans. But the dominant faction, especially, and there are others within other factions, there's a consensus that China isn't willing to throw its weight against the Americans in anything that conflicts America. So the only use that Pakistan could have with this, the only utility Pakistan would have with this relationship with China is dealing with India. That's the extent of it. They agreed to and went with the plan of the One Belt, One Road project, primarily because the state didn't have enough resources to build its infrastructure. And the Americans weren't willing to spend that money on them. And China used the exact same model that the Western investment model. They used the exact same model, but they were willing to invest. So the Pakistani military agreed. They even created a separate division to protect the Chinese investments within Pakistan, especially Balochistan and areas where they have difficulty controlling. So the military does think that China has a role to play, but not as a balancing force. They do not see China as a state that can counter the pressures America puts on them. So they only see them as partners that who can develop the infrastructure by giving them loans. That is the extent of it. And there's a bit of truth to this as well. Yeah. For instance, Pakistan's major 30% of Pakistan debt is to China, and Pakistan has an energy problem where most of its energy is produced in dollars. And it is paid in rupees. So there can never be a situation unless there is an export surplus, you would never be able to pay that dollar deficit back. And almost 25% of that monthly payment is to China. So China has followed the steps of the other capitalists who built ITPs and had contracts of being paid in capacity. That's something very interesting. So whenever somebody buys a service, you pay for what you get, right? But in Pakistan, there are independent power plants who get paid for their capacity to produce. Whether they produce anything or not, they'll get the amount of money for the capacity of production they have, and that too in dollars, while the economy that those power plants are serving in peace. So the experience has also been of a capitalist who is using either its excess capacity to offload its excess capacity within Pakistan markets, and is willing to help Pakistan win some of its military equipment. But it doesn't go beyond that. Whenever Pakistan has needed any support to posture or to resist any demands of the Americans, China hasn't offered anything. So the military sees China as a lightweight in the international economy. It doesn't see it as a partner that's dependent.
Earlier on, we spoke about the economy of Pakistan and its failure for decades and its inability of the establishment to move away from this neoliberal capitalist model, the IMF World Bank dependent model, and how that's created the anguish on the streets of Pakistan with hyperinflation and with very poor public services. Is there a movement in Pakistan against this? Is there a groundswell of opinion? Okay, yes, tonally there is, of course, but are there academics and thinkers who are trying to propose alternatives to this Western model?
So I'd say there's a dearth of creativity. There's absolutely no alternatives at the theta reg. There's only actually one narrative that's spoken about in the power corridors, and that is how much of the American plan would even limit. Although there are some conservative voices, especially in the Nawazi, who want to hold the American hand, but also not let it make the moves when they're implementing the IMF plan, the ones led by some old capitalists. But there's an alternative voice in Mr. Ismail within the Noon League as well, who wants to follow through with the American plan. But apart from them, there's some socialist voices who make some claims. But other than that, within the corridors, there's absolutely no conversation of this. But on the streets, I would say that there are people who do propose Islamic solutions to Iran. For instance, the idea of Pakistan's daughter deficit. That's primarily, so there is a conversation that Pakistan cannot be, at least in its initial stages, Pakistan cannot be a consumer economy to imported items if it has to survive. So you cannot manage this by increasing prices. If you do this, you destroy. It's like trying to help somebody with cancer. You have to be, it's a delicate situation. You can't chop off a limb and say the cancer is resolved, right? So you have to be more, there are steps to the procedure you'll have to take. So the first step has to be that you stop depending on the dollar, you stop depending on the dollar for your energy needs. That has to be the first step. And you'll have to use local resources to build an ecosystem for at least those things that are essential. For example, so there is a voice that says that Pakistan has to be food self-sufficient. We even importing wheat, like right now. We are importing cotton to produce our yarns. So those things that can be produced, that can be grown in Pakistan, they have to be grown within Pakistan. And then those things that are required to the energy that is required to run the industry, that has to be in a local currency as well. So, for instance, there is a voice that says that if we were to integrate the economy of Central Asia, Iran, Afghanistan with Pakistan, like a single economy, then you would be able to deal in the same currency when you're buying coal, gas, and oil, and water resources to generate the energy. And that's the only, if we have these two things in place, you will be in a position to bargain with the Western world to give you a share of the global supply chain. Unless this is in place, you have no bargaining chips. And whatever models you implement, they get you deeper into the debt traps that Pakistan is in.
Ashabai, we have a lot of students who come to Britain to study economics from Pakistan. Are you saying to me that they go back to Pakistan and for another generation, they, for want of a better word, destroy their country?
That's an unfortunate reality that there are people who have studied from
LSE
and Harvard and the Chicago School, but the policy prescription, they're stuck within the capitalist framework. You'll find people who are either fans of Milton Friedman or who are fans of John Maynard Keynes. So you wouldn't find, and both ideas within Pakistan, they talk about either it's it's privatizing and letting go of all the infrastructure that's causing Pakistan fiscal woes, or they talk about printing money to build infrastructure. Now, those are the only things they speak about. And the problem with this is that if we were to give credence to the voice of the street, which is that nothing apart from Islam is acceptable. There's a part of the narrative that says the state is illegitimate because it doesn't help them practice Islam, or rather it impedes, it creates problems for them when they're practicing Islam. So if that narrative is given any voice, or if it's taken into consideration, the Keynesian and neoliberal ideas will only build a society that talks about employment. That means living a life where people work more than 40 or 50 hours a week. They're displaced to urban areas. They lose their contact with their immediate families. They spend years, maybe half of their life, gaining an education and not getting married on time. So all of this is financed through an interest-based framework. So you, no matter what prescription they put forward, it makes sure that a social, an Islamic social life cannot be practiced, where silahami is impossible, where attending funerals is impossible, where making sure that the five prayers that you do at the mosque close to your house is impossible, where making sure that you're connected with your extended family is impossible. So even if these policy prescriptions were to pay dividends of whatever they promised that they could achieve, they wouldn't be able to create an Islamic society. And that is where the undercurrent would always reject any of these prescriptions. So even if they were to resolve inflation, which I would posit that it's impossible to do with these prescriptions, even if they were to industrialize Pakistan, but what they would do it at a cost, the people are not willing to bear that. And that current is becoming stronger and stronger. And it's very evident in the way that people have supported Imran Khan in his call for the Medina, Riyasat al-Madin.
So, Kashif, there is a need to establish a policy think tank in Pakistan where like-minded people like you come together and develop new initiatives and new thinking about our economic and political problems, probably.
I agree with that. So I would posit that I said there are four historical things that impact the Pakistan politics. The fourth one is Pakistan's connection with the Mughal Empire and the Islamic heritage of this place. And the custodian of that heritage is the ulama. And unfortunately, the ulama have allowed themselves to disconnect from this reality, and they're the people who least understand how the world is operating. And I think there is an immense need to facilitate these people who understand Islam in terms of Ahkam al-Sharia, but are not well-versed in how the world is playing this out, and how can they become a force of guiding people of what is the Islamic principle in following certain initiative. So I completely agree there's a need to develop a faith tank that allows people to develop a framework where they can understand the moves the world is making, the moves people are making within Pakistan. And I think we as a whole, as a society, it's not just the ulama, but I think they can play a major role in this. We as a society have to become politically savvy enough so that we can think of a place outside of the world order where we can implement Islam and not just Islam, but be connected with them. So the saying of Rabia ibn Amr, the Sahabi, it always keeps ringing in my head when the governor of Persia asked him, what are you here for? I paraphrased him. And he wanted to understand that whether it's worldly gains that they're after, and if that's what they want, we said we can offer you that. And he trampled those riches with his spear when he walked towards him. And he said that we are here to turn people from worship, the slaving of people, we're here to make people slaves of Allah, from slaves of people. And that's what the Islamic project is all about. Unless the people who are sincere to such a cause, who want to be slaves of Allah, unless they're empowered enough to see how the world is operating, and how the world is making sure that you stay slave to other qualities, other superpowers, where people within your society who hold the reins of power think that Razib is not Allah, it's America, where they think that it's the Chinese who win you back to it. It's not the Malaika who Allah Subhanahu wa Taala sends, and it's the American machinery that makes sure that people are fed, and it's not the barakah from Allah Subhanahu wa Taala. So it's people who are true to these beliefs who need to become politically aware, so that they can transition the whole society. And I'm very confident that since I mentioned that even within the power corridors, there are people who are sincere to Islam, but they think that Islam is a separate domain and these policy matters is a separate domain. So even they need to be educated. So I'm completely on board with your perception.
Kashif Gilani, I think this has been a fascinating conversation. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for your time,
bro. Oh, yeah, it was a pleasure talking.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkingmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there. Especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.